Nicely done, Terry. And I also agree no one should ever wear anything that says Kansas Jayhawks on it. But with Ben's admonition, well, I'll try to be tolerant. Our subject tonight, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some thoughts with you, is a letter to the church. And I imagine most of us at various times have pondered, what if our congregation got a letter from Paul or from Christ? Or what if I got a letter from them? When I was asked to talk on this, I was at first honored for the opportunity, but I didn't give a whole lot of thought to the topic right then, but I later obviously had to. And I found it had several difficulties, not inappropriate difficulties, just difficulties. One of the difficulties I found is the generalness of the assignment. In the Bible, Paul wrote to seven different churches. Jesus, in Revelations 2 and 3, wrote to seven different churches. And each church, each congregation, has its own specific idiosyncrasies and problems. So I thought, whatever I say about congregations in general won't necessarily apply to yours, but it might apply to somebody else's. And with our selective osmotic reasoning, we'll assume all the bad ones don't apply to our congregation and all the good ones do. The second difficulty that I found as I prepared my thoughts was the tendency to focus on the negative. I don't know if it's simply human nature or if it's speaker nature. It seems so much easier sometimes from the pulpit to focus on the negative rather than on the positive. So I could come up with a list of 10 things you people need to straighten out, but I chose not to do it that way. And I don't think that's really what the brethren here requested or wanted me to do. Paul did a masterful job in his epistles in blending together the positive along with the negative. I don't think any of his epistles were all negative. He always found something positive. Maybe it's just coincidence, maybe it's biblical symmetry. Paul wrote to seven churches: Romans, Corinth, Galatia, Ephesians, Philippi, Colossae, Thessalonica. Jesus wrote to seven churches: Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. They each wrote to the church at Ephesus, so we have 14 letters, 13 churches. But as I began to put my mental and then to the paper list of things to consider, positive and negative, one aspect seemed to consistently fall on the ledger of both, and that is the family. The family consistently seemed to play a great role in each of the considerations that I listed for myself, be they positive or negative. I'm sometimes asked as to why some congregations grow and others wilt. I don't have all of the answers to that, but I do know one of the crowning answers is how we deal with our families at home. And then it has a tremendous impact on the church. This is not going to be a lesson on the family. I'm just giving you an overriding thought that almost everything I say is going to affect or be affected by the family. God gave us three great institutions. He gave us the civil government to protect our lives. He gave us the church to protect our souls. And He gave us our homes to protect the family. But which one did He give us first? The family. Without strong spiritual families, and I'm not talking about filial strength, that's fine. We love physically our families. I'm talking about spiritual strength in our families. Without that, the church suffers. Without that, congregations cease to exist. It's not enough for our families to have strong loyalties, love, kinship. That's good, but it's not enough. We need strong spiritual families because without them, we will have no leaders for the church. We will not keep our young people in the church, and we will not be a light unto the world. Physical families that are in the Lord are wonderful, absolutely wonderful. But not if they supersede the spiritual family, cause others to feel excluded. We use our physical families to be somewhat cliquish or clannish. Mark referenced Hug a Porcupine. I remember that talk rather well. In an assembly like this, there are people here who are not always with us. Maybe from small congregations that you don't know them. Let me suggest to you that they're not porcupines, but they're the ones we need to be hugging to make sure they feel a part of what maybe you already feel a part of. So I'm going to begin with a couple of three positives, if I was supposing what maybe the letter would contain. And then we'll deal with some other issues. I believe there is some really good work being done by and for some of our young people. In the state of Iowa, the northern parts of Missouri, southern Iowa, Kansas City, and Kansas, frequently some of you open up your homes, make sure the young people get together, and they study. Not just at a meeting like this, maybe on a monthly basis. I've been privileged to work with some of them. I suppose probably John and others have too. That is an absolutely outstanding work that will, time after time after time, pay dividends. Will it solve all of our problems? Will it keep all of our young people? No. But I think that is an absolutely great work. The Gregory Boulevard congregation several years ago started having a winter study for young people. I don't know how many they have, 70, 80? That's good stuff. Last year, Smart Road, since we didn't have a two-week meeting, maybe the last two, but at least the last year, had one for the slightly older group. Some wonderful teaching, fellowship. I take my hats off to that. Failure to keep and develop our youth is absolutely suicidal. And congregations that don't grow, congregations that wilt, are often congregations that don't keep their young people. I'm not sure if it's a cause or effect or both, but I do see that similarity. Maybe that's why in Deuteronomy chapter 6, he says, teach your children when you're standing, when you're sitting. I think that's an absolutely wonderful work that is going on. I don't know the most difficult time of life, but youth certainly has its challenges. And scriptures represent youth as a time both of danger and of challenge. Moses said that the imagination of a man's heart is evil from his youth. Exodus chapter. Paul admonished Timothy to flee youthful lusts. Young people have an energy, a daring, maybe hearts filled with visions of the future that don't have all of the rough edges off that maybe a little more wisdom will bring. But they're such a valuable component of the Lord's family. Not simply because they will take our place, we pray that happens. I think they're a valuable component for what they have to offer right now. in their youth. Sometimes youth is impetuous. Sometimes it's a bit silly. Some of us never get rid of that. But it's a wonderful resource for the kingdom of God. And I applaud all of the good work that I see and sense going on in the brotherhood regarding that. Another positive that came to my mind that might or might not have come to your mind is, I just call it the diversity of leadership. And I need to consider a bit of a historical reference for that. In my father's youth, and some of your parents' youth, there was a lot of good teaching that went on. Men like Carl Ketcherside, E.M. Zur, and you can add to that list, did a lot of that good teaching. But as I look back on it, and I wasn't alive at that time, it seems to me like there was an excessive charismatic attraction by some Christians to some of those leaders. And when any of those leaders, one of them that I mentioned I believe did, fell away, it was very injurious to the church. Therefore, a great following fell from the truth. I don't sense that today. We have men in the brotherhood that we admire, that we look up to. But I don't sense that if one or two of those, some would follow them, I'm sure, but I don't sense it would have the impact that it had back in the 50s, 60s. And I think that's good. I see it, but I don't see it as strongly. Sometimes when I'm at a meeting like this, and I haven't seen it this time, I see what I sense as a little bit of a groupie phenomenon around evangelists that makes me a little uncomfortable. Because I can tell you from at least my personal experience, that they got the same problems you got. They struggle. They have trouble. To admire and honor and look up to one another, that's fine, but to be mesmerized to the point of maybe it causing us spiritual harm is not good. And I don't see that today like maybe it was. So I put that under the "what a go, guys" category. Now I'm into chapter 2. So now we'll deal with the "I have a few oughts against you." And I don't think that my opinions on this are any better than yours. And you could make a list that would be just as good as mine. I chose not to make a list of 12. I've only got 2 or 3. So that I could spend a little bit more time on them. But there is a growing mentality, maybe not within the church, but sometimes within the church, that the church has to adapt because it's outmoded. The idea is rooted in the cultural phenomenon called societal osmosis. Somebody asked me during the break, how long do I think it will take for some of the things that Mark and Ben talked about this afternoon to start affecting the church? Well, historically, societal things have taken 10 to 15 years before they begin affecting the church, but we may have moved into a little more rapid progress. More and more Protestant organizations are succumbing to the homosexual movement. I don't feel that our congregations have succumbed to that, but we're being affected by it. I can thankfully say I know of no congregation in the sphere of my work that has succumbed to that. But there are those who have succumbed to what I call the MDR arena. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Matthew chapter 19, verse 5 and following. Jesus says this: "For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Wherefore ye are no more two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. They said to him, "Why did Moses then command them to give a right of divorcement and to put her away?" And he said unto them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so." Verse 9, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her which is put away committeth adultery." I wonder if we got a letter from Paul or from Christ. He might simply say, "What part of Matthew 19 don't you understand?" The allowing of the sharing of the same abode prior to marriage. Even when people say, "Well, nothing's going on." Oh, come on. Occasional attitude toward remarriage. I believe there are biblical reasons that allow remarriage. Unfaithfulness and the death of a mate. That's what Jesus said. Paul doesn't correct what Jesus said. He may have added to it and implemented it, but he didn't correct it. What Jesus said for me still stands. What part of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 don't we understand when it says, "Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers"? Which word there is so hard to understand? No, it's not the words. It's not the concept that's hard to understand. We just don't like it sometimes. And I wonder if the Lord might not call us on that. When our heart, and we need heart, but when our heart overtakes our mind, we have a problem. When our emotions overtake obedience. And there isn't a family... I'm going to go out a little broadly, but I don't think it's much of a limb. There's not a family here, including mine, that hasn't been touched by this issue. I'm not talking at you, I'm talking with you. And if you don't understand how my family's been touched, you come to me, I'll tell you. Mark made a comment in his talk about how we need to practice contentment. I don't know that he used this passage. I agree totally with him. But Paul says, "I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content." Why did he have to learn it? Because it doesn't come naturally. In our marriages, it doesn't always come naturally. We have to learn to be content. Now, some of you have such wonderful marriages that you haven't had to work at it. Or you don't feel like you've had to work at it. Your mate might differ. Mine would. But you know what I'm saying. You work at it. You work at it. And that point, I think, moves into my second point under the "I have oughts against you." This is not me having oughts against you. It's the Scripture. I worry about our next generation of leaders. Because I don't always see them. Many congregations simply don't have a bullpen. I call it a bullpen. Those are people you can bring in when the starters are exhausted. But we need a bullpen. Men, families that are developing themselves to be the next group of leaders. In whatever capacity. And it may not even be an official capacity. A lot of you are leaders in your congregation and you don't have the title elder or deacon or evangelist. You're still a pillar, or you can be. Lives that disqualify seemingly other good men, marital decisions, child-rearing decisions. I've lost count of the men that I think could be good leaders if their background was not soiled. And maybe a soiled background bespeaks their judgment, so maybe that's the reason. So Sometimes I see an unwillingness for qualified people, in my humble opinion, an unwillingness for them to serve. I don't know how to relate that to the parable of the talents, where it says, if you've got a talent, use it. There's lots of things I would prefer not to do if I could convince myself God would be pleased with me if I didn't do them. And I imagine every leader here could say the same thing. Not that I'm a leader, but they are. In 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 9 and following, Elijah and Elisha cross over. And that's the passage where Elijah is taken up. And it says, his mantle fell to the ground. You know what Elisha did? He picked up Elijah's mantle and carried it back over. You and I think of countless men and women in our congregations who we have leaned on, depended on, and they have gone on. And metaphorically, symbolically, or almost literally, they left mantles on the floor for us to pick up. Elisha did. It's always been an essential part of God's plan. But how can it please the Lord when qualified people refuse to serve? Because it's work. How do you think that pleases God? Or when unqualified people are appointed simply because we've got an opening. That one I don't understand. I will probably never see a congregation where all of the men are officers, but that would be just wonderful. A congregation where every man in the congregation is qualified to be an officer, and he is. I'll probably never see that. But I do see congregations saying, well, nobody's died yet, so let's don't worry about it. To me, that's backwards. Absolutely backwards. I ran across this saying, and it's just been in my mind. We jump at the alarm of a Seiko and yet snooze through the calling of the Almighty. Could it be that God is calling you, me, to an enhanced service task? And we're just snoozing through his call. The last one I have under the negative category, I'll probably spend the most time on, but I want to end on some positives. And that's the loss of enthusiasm. And I want to spend some time on this because this may be the one that you and I in this assembly struggle with the most. Oh, there may be people here that have marital problems. I'm sure there are. There are people here who could be serving in leadership roles that aren't. That's possible. But I think almost every one of us may struggle with this. I do. The loss of enthusiasm for the work. Life is a race, it's a marathon, and the key is to find a 26-mile pace, since it's a marathon, and sustain it. In spiritual life, many start out with an enthusiastic sprint, only to end up either walking or sitting before they finish the race. And that's a loss of endurance, it's a loss of enthusiasm. You know, it was Solomon who said, there's nothing new under the sun, and I appreciate that more all the time. If I were to ask you what the Lord had against the church at Ephesus, most of you could answer. They had lost their first love. You think that means they no longer believed in Jesus? You think that means they no longer loved Jesus? Well, that's a possibility. I just don't think it's a probability. I think it means they had lost their passion to serve Him. I contrast that with Paul's words when he said, I press toward the mark. There is a great thief among us. Not amongst them, amongst us. What does he steal? He steals our excitement, our enthusiasm, and maybe his name is overfamiliarity. Now, how can overfamiliarity be a bad thing in the Christian walk? Well, let's just think a little bit about it. We become so familiar with spiritual truth and worship that we allow ourselves to lose our passion. Jesus called that losing our first love. The last letter he wrote at the end of Revelation 3, he talked about that to a congregation about being lukewarm. He never condemned the Laodiceans because they didn't assemble together. He wasn't condemning the Ephesians because they didn't assemble. It had to do with passion, enthusiasm, that was needed if we're going to bring life to dead souls, keep the army advancing, and keep the actions of our service meaningful. We're talking about the inability or the unwillingness to sustain enthusiasm for spiritual things. Too often, repetition leads to monotony, which leads to a loss of passion. It needn't, but it often does. The old truths, despite their truth, their source, God, no longer excites and motivates us like it once did. We still believe. We still worship, in a fashion. But I wonder if we don't sometimes lose sight of the awe of God. Some of you right now are having trouble concentrating on what I'm saying. I can tell by where you're looking and the expressions on your faces. And that may be because of my inability to present what I'm thinking. But I suspect it's symptomatic of something more serious than me. Lest you think I'm excluding myself from this, I am not. And I'll just get personal very briefly. I went back and counted. On an average year, I present roughly 200 lessons or sermons every year. I go to congregations where I've over the years given 150 to 175 lessons. Sometimes I feel like I could just do it in my sleep. But that's not good. It's not good at all. It's hard to keep the passion and the enthusiasm. And I don't always. And when I don't, I think you see that. It's obvious. You're not dumb. Well, most of you. Habit and continuation are often good, but not when they are accompanied by a loss of edge and passion and enthusiasm. And when and if that happens, we begin to say yes rather than no to the distractions of life. And when we do that, it results in us saying no rather than yes to God and His work. Just because we don't forsake the assembly, and I suspect I'm looking at people that don't forsake the assembly. You wouldn't be here on a Saturday if you were assembly forsakers. Just because we don't forsake the assembly does not mean we can't forsake the work. Enthusiasm and passion. In the 1940s, when my father began preaching, he began, I think, preaching in 41 or 2. Shortly after that, or about that time, they had 6 weeks Bible studies in St. Louis. People would go in the winter for 6 weeks. Now, it was in a more of an agricultural society, so in the winter months, farmers could get away a little easier. I understand that. Why do you think they had those? I think it's because a few people got excited about the idea and made it happen. More recently, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the congregation at Independence, Missouri, got excited about something that they called the two-week meeting. Why did that happen? Because a few people there got excited about it and made it happen. Now, we may have shot ourselves in the foot a little bit on the two-week meeting because we sometimes maybe made it more of a social extravaganza than a Bible, exhaustive Bible study, but a lot of good came out of that. I met my wife there at one of them. Fifteen or so years ago at Smart Road, we started a young men's Bible study during the winter. And that went on for a while, but now it's a little different. Things do run their course, I understand it. But why did that happen? A few people got excited about it. I was recently with an elder. I'll just say recently, because then you might be able to pin it down. Who had a nine or ten day, summer 2 week meeting study, all lined out. He had topics, he even had possible teachers. He had a notebook about that thick. He was excited about it. He got me excited about it. I asked him if he had shared it to the other officers in his congregation, and he said yes. I said, what did they say? They said, it's too much work. Well, he's not giving up. It may still happen. And that doesn't have to be the outlet. But it's that enthusiasm and passion that really drives good things. I fear the loss of passion and enthusiasm for all of us assembled here tonight. I fear that. I'm not saying you have all lost your passion and enthusiasm, because I don't believe that. But I do fear that, because I know how easily it can happen. Especially those of us who have gotten serious about spiritual things, who are at the building every time the doors open, who attend most or many of the meetings like this. We maybe are the ones most likely to listen to the thief who says to us, oh, you've heard that before. What's said that you haven't heard many times? Oh, every once in a while a new guy comes along who has a new slant or a louder voice that holds our attention for a while, but that response doesn't last. And we start looking at our watch. How much longer is this going to keep on going? Well, you have to answer whether you've ever done that before, but some of you have just betrayed yourself, so we'll leave it at that. Paul talks about in Galatians 6:9 becoming weary in well doing. I want to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 for just a moment, where Paul goes back and recounts some of the story of the Israelites very briefly. And I'm interested in the first four or five verses right now where the word all is repeatedly used. Listen to this. Moreover, brethren, I would not have you ignorant that you should be ignorant how that all of our fathers were under the cloud. They're all in the same place. All were inundated or baptized under that cloud. Verse 2. They all ate the same spiritual meat. They all did drink the same spiritual drink, verse 4, of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Now listen to verse 5. But with many of them God was not well pleased. They all had the same exposure to the same God. They had the same exposure to the same spiritual food. They had the same exposure to the same spiritual drink. They had the same fellowship one with another, and yet many of them were not pleasing unto God. Verse 7 and 8 says they became idolaters. William Warfield, 105 years ago, to a group of Bible students at Princeton University, and Princeton was quite different 105 years ago than it is now. I wouldn't call it a church, but it was more moral and spiritually oriented than it certainly is now. Wrote the following to his Bible students. And I think these words are still fitting or things that we ought to consider. And I quote, "We are frequently told indeed that the great danger of the Bible student lies precisely in his constant contact with divine things. They may seem to become common to him because they are customary. As the average man breathes the air and basks in the sunshine without even a thought that it is God in his goodness who makes the sun to rise on them, even though they are evil, and sends rain upon them, even though they are unjust. Oh, you may come to handle even the furniture of the sanctuary without even a thought above the gross earthly materials of which it is made. The words that tell you of God's terrible majesty or his glorious goodness may come to be mere words to you. Hebrew and Greek words with etymologies and inflections, connections of reasoning, to establish to you the mysteries of his saving activities, may come to you no more. Logical paradigms and premises and conclusions fitly framed, no doubt, and triumphantly cogent, but with no significance to you as to what their formal logical conclusiveness is. That is," he said, "your greatest danger. But it is not your greatest danger only because, or it is your greatest danger only because it is your greatest privilege," end quote. He was warning his students who were about to embark on life that don't allow your familiarity with things to cause you to lose your enthusiasm for them. You and I have the greatest opportunity to study and proclaim God's Word. But if we are not careful, it becomes just another compartment of our lives rather than the totality of our lives. Maybe that's why Jesus told the Ephesians, "You have lost your first love," or maybe that's why he described the Laodiceans as lukewarm. Our once yeses to God when we are so enthusiastic gradually fade into no's if we're not careful. Our so's become so what's. Our do's lose their diligence. If Jesus were to say, "I have one thing against you," it might well be you have lost your passion. Now that's not a universal statement, but it's one that some of us probably need to consider. Tomorrow is not just another Sunday, not just another class, not just another sermon, not just another Lord's Supper. This is not just another meeting. These are precious times that we all need to latch on to and invigorate ourselves and restore our passion if that's needed. One of the most troubling passages for me in the Bible is found in Matthew chapter 7, where he says, "And many will say unto me, Lord, Lord, have we not done these wonderful things? And I will have to say, depart, I never knew you. Lord, Lord, have we not assembled every Sunday?" Well, that's important, but not without passion and not without devotion. Let's not forget, brothers and sisters, what a privilege it is to be among God's people and to be within His Word. Enthusiastically marching on. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm." You ever notice how when we have the privilege of maybe starting a new congregation, it's just woo. That's a wonderful feeling. But I've lived long enough to see the woo go to woo. And so have you. Now, I understand it's hard to keep a fever pitch all of the time. But it may be important to do a little better job than we have. In Joshua chapter 1, and I'm not going to take the time to turn back and read it, when the baton was passed from Moses to Joshua, in Joshua 1, verse 6, 7, 9, and 18, he says, "Be strong and of good courage." Because God knew that's what Joshua was going to need. I think He might say to you and I, "Be strong and of good courage. Be enthusiastic." Well, let me end rather briefly on a couple of positives. And I do mean briefly. I would give the Brotherhood rather, in my humble assessment, glowing marks on the way we have supported our evangelists in the field. It seems to me that the Brotherhood that I'm familiar with has been quite generous to our evangelists, maybe at times overly generous. I'm not sure I can judge that because I don't know the numbers. But I think there's been a lot of good work done in that. I know a lot of congregations where a high percentage of their budget is for that. And I think that would please the Lord. Now, whether those receiving it and those overseeing it use it well, that's another issue. But I think I compliment the Brotherhood for that. I remember when we started Smart Road, we had to go through the building process, which took a lot of our finances. And we long for the day when, I'll just put a number out there because I don't know what it is, 80% of our funds could go to evangelism. I don't know if that's what it is now. Someone here could speak to that, but it's high. That's good. The other area that I'd want to just mention as I begin to close is the friendships that are forged for a lifetime. When I say this next phrase, it's going to sound like Tom Dennis is here, which isn't the worst thing. You young people. I can't do his voice, but those are his words. You don't realize how important these friendships you're forming are. Rick and I were together last weekend just kind of reminiscing. Our first real recollection of each other, Rick Sparks, recollection of each other was 1968, Martinsville, Indiana, 2-week meeting. He and I and Lowell Herman, they stayed with me at my house. Who would have thought 2 or 3 years later we'd still be good friends? Now it's been more than 2 or 3, hadn't it? Try 50. You just don't know how it's going to work out. Rick's a fellow evangelist. Lowell's an elder at Pleasant Hill. And I could go on and on with people that I met, including my wife. And I probably misstated that somehow because I got lots of smiles. But I'll find out on the way home what I said. But not just the young people. Those of us that are a little more, we're meeting new people. This is wonderful. Samuel Coleridge, an English poet who had a very sad life. I'll just say he was a drug addict, opium, died at a fairly early age. But he wrote a lot of classic writings. His most famous is the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Some of you may have read that. But in a lesser-known writing, he talks about the friendship is a sheltering tree. When I look out here, I just see limbs all over the place holding you all together because of friendship. There is not a single person in this assembly that I would know if it were not for the Lord Jesus Christ. There's not a one of you I would know. And I know you all because of that. And I cherish those friendships. I see in the brotherhood those wonderful friendships. They give us spiritual strength. They give us emotional strength. They give us physical strength. And I say to you, as one who's been privileged to go through that process to some extent, nurture every single one of them you can. Because they are precious. They are precious. And you just never know how precious they will be. Well, that's enough of sounding like an old man, because I know that's what it sounded like. But I'm knocking on that door. As we look at the larger picture, we have some positive trends, very positive trends and activities to build on. And I applaud, salute, and am so thankful for you for providing those things. But we do have some work to do. Be ye not weary in well-doing. What if he wrote a letter to us? Well, if I was only talking to one congregation, I could have dealt with some maybe specifics of your congregation from my perspective. But we have such a plethora of congregations here, I had to go a little more general. But it only takes one or two really enthusiastic people within a group to be a contagious process and march them on. I've seen more than one congregation appear to be gone, dying, and one or two or three things fall just right and someone really gets excited and you just get out of their way because they and the Lord are going. That's a wonderful thing to see. You are a good people. But let's not let the familiarity of our worship, the familiarity of our songs, the familiarity of our time together, to cause us to lose the energy and the passion that can so marvelously allow His family to march forward. We're going to close our thoughts and extend the gospel invitation at this time. Dylan's picked out a number for us. If you have something that would be appropriate to share, certainly if you have not accepted the Lord, that is more than appropriate to share. If we can help anybody in any way as we close out our lesson, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.